Hi, I'm Dr. Jarrett, and welcome to the Plantastic Podcast, a show for plant killers, green thumbs, and everyone else in between. Listen along as I deconstruct the craft and practices of remarkable horticulturists so that you can better cultivate your plants and yourself. Let's grow.
Hey, Plantastic peeps, it's Dr. Jarrett. Matrix planting. You know, I've always wondered where that term originated. Recently, reading the book Pete Out Off at Work helped me understand. In the early 2000s, when this naturalistic approach was new, they needed a name to describe planting high-impact species that arose from a dominant ground cover layer. The inspiration for a name came from geology, of all places. A rock like a conglomerate or a porphyry that is composed of multiple smaller different rocks has this fine-grained uniform material that surrounds and supports those embedded rocks, and that is called the matrix. Now, after hearing that little story, you may better understand where that name came from. But if you still find yourself confused about this planting style, I'm hosting a live webinar on matrix planting Monday, August 4th at 6 p.m. Central. In Matrix Planting Made Easy, you'll learn how to create a resilient, beautiful, and low-maintenance planting. I'll walk you through what matrix planting actually is, how to build and layer a successful matrix, what types of plants to use, and how to adapt your matrix for different site conditions. We'll explore practical planting tips, visual examples, and strategies to avoid common mistakes. And we'll have a short Q&A at the end. You can find a discount link at meristemhorticulture.com/discount, and I've also included it in the show notes of your podcast app for easy access. After August 4th, the price goes up. Spots are limited, so once they're gone, you'll have to watch the recording later. If you have any questions you want covered in the session, just message me at theplantasticpodcast.com, because the goal of this webinar is to help you better understand how to plant. This month is episode 44 with Kelly Holbrooks, who talks about conservation at one of my favorite botanic gardens, Southern Highlands Reserve. With decades of experience in Western North Carolina's vast horticulture, Kelly demonstrates her passion for fostering human connection with nature in everything she does. For more than a decade as executive director of Southern Highlands Reserve, a nonprofit native plant garden and research center on Toxaway Mountain, Kelly has built a network of conservationists and advocates for preserving the unique ecosystem of the Southern Appalachian Mountains. Kelly's research in experiential methods and the humanism of nature earned her a master's degree in landscape architecture with honors from the College of Environment and Design at the University of Georgia. She also earned bachelor's degrees in international studies and political science from Rhodes College, where she was a three-sport NCAA athlete. She is a founding member of the Southern Appalachian Spruce Restoration Initiative, a public-private partnership working to restore the second most endangered ecosystem in the United States, the high-elevation spruce fir forest of the Southern Blue Ridge. She is a member of the Red Spruce Technical Advisory Board, headed by the Nature Conservancy to make recommendations to the U.S. Forest Service for their regional planning efforts. She also participates in the quarterly All Lands meeting held by the U.S. Forest Service to develop a long-term collaborative plan for natural resource conservation across her region. Kelly enjoys hiking, gardening, yoga, and playing in nature with her family. She is proud to call Western North Carolina her home. If you've never heard of Southern Highlands Reserve, you'll want to go. This magical garden, located at 4,500 feet elevation in the mountains of Western North Carolina, has to be seen to be believed. Kelly shares how the reserve's approach of don't mess it up, just polish the stone, can inspire gardeners like you to enhance what nature is already doing in your spaces rather than override it. We dive into lessons from red spruce restoration, stormwater smart design, assisted migration, and the biodiversity potential of cultivated spaces. Kelly also offers practical takeaways on observing plant communities, embracing long-term thinking, and building partnerships that multiply your impact. Whether you're managing a native garden, public space, or home landscape, this episode is full of ideas to help you care for plants and place more meaningfully. You can find links we discuss and access details from this conversation on the show notes at theplantasticpodcast.com. And you can learn more about Kelly and Southern Highlands Reserve at Southern highlandsreserve.org. That's SOUTHERNHIGHLANDSRESERVE.org. And on Instagram at Southern_Highlands_Reserve. So without further ado, please enjoy this plantastic conversation with Kelly Holbrooks. Hi, Kelly, and welcome to the Plantastic Podcast. I'm so excited to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Jared. It's my pleasure to be here. It's a beautiful day in Western North Carolina. Anytime I get a chance to talk to another plant nerd, I'm in.
Yeah, and you're right after my own heart talking about Western North Carolina there. Yeah. So tell us about where your passion for plants germinated.
It really goes back to my childhood. I grew up in Tennessee, gardening and playing in the woods with all the neighbor kids, my brother and my grandmother, my mother and my father were all gardeners. And there are pictures of me before I can remember in a cloth diaper and a bonnet running around in a vegetable garden having the time of my life.
That's awesome. Where are you from in Tennessee?
Chattanooga.
Oh, nice. So I'm from the opposite corner of the state, from Union City.
Okay.
I don't know if you know it or not, but it's a smaller town. Yeah. But I have fond memories of coming to Chattanooga as a kid and seeing the aquarium and Sea Rock City and just experiencing. And the other thing, too, is just seeing the mountains. I think that was the first trip we really made to the mountains and starting to learn that habitat in the area.
Same. Yeah. I think it definitely, I know that it informed who I am professionally and personally, for sure. No doubt.
Yeah. Where did you go to school and what did you study?
Undergrad, I went to Rhodes College, was out in Memphis.
Okay. Yeah.
And that was a very different landscape.
Humidity's so thick, you can cut it with a knife.
Yeah. I remember calling my mom at some point and I was like, why did you let me move out here? It is so flat and it is so gray. But I was obsessed with soccer. So that sort of, she had no choice. And I studied international studies and political science. I was actually going to be an environmental lawyer.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. As life goes, it's not always as you plan. And so when I got out, I was working, just figuring out what I wanted to do, trying to study for the LSAT, but not really being successful. And I started to pay attention to that. And then I just started working with landscaping businesses. I had this 4-year college degree, and I was doing all this manual labor with all these other people and really learning from them. And I just loved it. And so at that point, I shifted and went back and got my master's at Georgia in landscape architecture.
Awesome. So what eventually led you into the public gardening realm?
I wanted to make a bigger impact. And I felt like having a foot in the public realm would give more opportunity for that. I really believe that our gardens, whether it's your personal garden or a public garden, I think that there's so many things. It's an oasis. You can just go there for a respite or to clear your head or just be in nature. But it's also a big educational piece of how we can really shift things culturally. And that was exciting to me.
Yeah. Awesome. Did you have other jobs before you started at Southern Highlands Reserve in the public garden realm?
Not in the public garden realm. I thought my parents were going to lose it. I called them and told them I was going to use all the money in my savings account to go take a job as a mow crew leader on a landscaping business in Asheville that paid way less than I needed. And they were like, she has lost her mind. But I wanted to learn everything about the business. I wanted to learn all of the maintenance. I wanted to learn all of the management. I wanted greenhouse experience. I was a pesticide applicator for a year just so I could learn it and just really have that breadth of knowledge before I went back to get my design degree.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. I don't think you're alone in your experience. because I've encountered a number of people who have felt the pressure from parents or family members mm-hmm. whenever they try to pursue plants as a passion. What advice do you have for them?
Always trust your gut. Listen to your heart. Your mind will play tricks on you. I'm old enough now to be able to admit that. And I really wish that everyone on the planet could go after what they're passionate about. I think we would be a much happier species on the planet if we could.
Yeah. Amen to that. Amen to that. So talk to us about how you found your way to Southern Highlands Reserve.
Really interesting story. And this folds right into like trusting your gut. I'm at Georgia, University of Georgia and College of Environment Design. I had just finished I was halfway through my second year. It's a 3-year program. It's halfway through my second year. And I finished my finals. And anytime I was not in school, I booked it straight back up to Western North Carolina. Summers, fall breaks, weekends, just back up here. And I came up for the holiday break. And that year, I want to say it was like 2009, 2010. And we got a lot of snow that year. And it was back to back. And so the snow stayed on the ground for 2 weeks, which is not normal down here. And I just found this restaurant in town. And I said, you know what? I'm going to treat myself. I'm going to go get myself a dinner. I crushed it this semester, feeling good about it. And I go down there and there are these gentlemen at the bar. And they said, what do you do? And I said, I'm an aspiring landscape designer, landscape architect in school. And they said, have you ever heard of this place called Southern Highlands Reserve? It's a native plant arboretum and research center. And I said, you guys are messing with me. I've been living here for over 10 years. And I've never heard of this place. And are you guys pulling my leg? And they're like, no, it's for real. And so we exchanged numbers and they kept peppering the director at the time. And I kept peppering the director at the time. And finally, I got in February for an interview to be an intern that summer. I will never forget the drive up. I drove up from Athens all the way up to the top of Toxway Mountain. And February up there is interesting. It's,
oh, yeah.
You know, high elevation. It's got this, I always refer to as like a scene out of a J.R. Tolkien book.
So, yeah.
And I drove in and I started looking at all the ecosystems and the rock work. And I was like, where am I? This is super cool. And it literally just was like kismet. And here I am 14 years later.
That's great. Such a great story. I think that other people out there have not ever heard of Southern Highlands Reserve, much like you were in the restaurant that night. So can you talk about how the place came to be and what species was really special as far as protecting?
Yes. Our founders, Robert and Betty Ballantyne, had the great vision of protecting this mountaintop. Ultimately, it's 120 acres under conservation easement in perpetuity. Of course, it wanted to be, at one point, was going to be developed into home sites. These endemic and rare ecosystems and species that exist on it are now protected, which is fantastic. But it basically started in the late 90s when they bought a lot across the street from the Southern Highlands Reserve and started to build their home there. And over time, they were just picking up parcels and were able to string them together in the conservation easement eventually in the early 2000s. And it was a classic case of not really knowing what exactly was there. They could feel how special it was. They knew that it was magnetic to them. But they did a really important thing. They brought people in that knew what they were doing, and they surveyed it and got an inventory. And at that point, it was like the flip. It went from, this is Robert and Betty's garden, to this is much bigger than we ever thought it would be. And it became the private operating foundation, the Southern Highlands Reserve.
Yeah. Wasn't part of it slated to be turned into development too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were going to do 21 to 22 homes over on this 60-acre piece that we have. And what's so terrible about that a lot of people don't know about is that there are 3 spray cliff waterfall communities over there, and those would have just been annihilated.
So, yeah. What is a spray cliff water community for those who may not know?
Yeah, I had to look it up too. I was like, a Spray Cliff waterfall community is, of course, a waterfall, but it has intermittent water in it. So it won't be continuously pouring out. So it's dependent on the weather.
Yeah, cool. And the rhododendron that, of course, is so special to y'all. That was another reason. That was another reason that it was protected as well, too.
Absolutely. I don't have this data in front of me that I can read out of a book, but as all good stories in the mountains go, the lore rings true. And I've been told that we have possibly the largest naturally occurring endemic stand of rhododendron faceae in the world.
Yeah, the pink shell. Yeah, that's so just amazing.
It's only in three places.
Yeah.
It's mind blowing. I think it's like Massachusetts, maybe Connecticut, and North Carolina. And it's considered vulnerable, so it's still doing okay. But anytime you have such a small population of any species, you're like, a few things could shift and it could go.
Yeah. Clearly, it takes many people to help Southern Highlands Reserve work. Who else helps to carry your mission forward?
Outside of the founders and the board, we have a small team. Holly Renahan is our communications manager and works remotely in Tallahassee. She's the magic woman behind the curtain, kind of keeping us all in order. And then on site, there is myself, Brent Antrim, our gardens manager, Cody Stanley, a gardener, and then a whole host of volunteers that help us every year. And then this summer, we've got two interns. We've got an intern from LSU.
Oh,
cool. In the MLA program named Catherine Frampton, and then a bachelor's student at NC State in landscape design and horticulture, and her name is Priscilla Ruiz.
Nice. So from what I understand about Southern Highlands Reserve, one of your core focuses is conservation. That's something that y'all really try to imbue and, as part of your mission, live out. Can you talk about some of the conservation efforts that y'all do for the flora of the Southern Appalachians and the Southeast U.S. as well?
Yes, you're exactly right. Our mission is this big visionary idea of what can this little small nonprofit do to help sustain the plants of the Southern Blue Ridge. The biodiversity is very high down here, and we want to be a part of that fight with everybody else that wants to keep it for generations to come. So we have carved out a way that we can, I think, really punch above our weight for a small staff. There's four of us on staff. We have amazing volunteers, amazing advocates that really help us get connected and be able to do this conservation work on a larger scale. So when people come to visit us, they can see Southern Highlands Reserve and the conservation we're doing on our in-situ collection, which is great and accessible for a lot of people, but really...
And what's an in-situ for people who may not know that too?
Yeah, our living collection. Yeah. What's in our gardens, right?
Yeah, yeah. And what's on site there too, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But I think what really is magical about the conservation work we do is when we work off our site or the ex situ collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we've been able to be a part of a couple of fun projects. I want to say, and maybe it was pre-pandemic, so it feels like a millennia ago, but we had this project in the Great Smokies National Park, and we were part of a wetland restoration. And that was super special to me because it was close to indigenous land, and we were looking to restore a stream that was full of invasives, and got to work with the National Park Service, Garden Club of America, and just really get in there and make it work. We ended up being the one that hit the home run because they sent the seed out to a couple different nurseries, and we were the only ones that could germinate. I think it may have just been an off year, who knows, but we were able to get some of those species into the stream bank for restoration. And it was just a really fun trip because you got to go to the Smokies, you got to see the synchronized fireflies all around.
Yeah.
And then another project that we've been working on is actually with Atlanta Botanical Garden. And they were wanting to know if we could grow Torreya or Toria, depending on motto, whatever. And they send us all these seeds, about 500 of them. And one of its common names is stinking cedar. And we found out that first year why it's called that, because we got every squirrel in the county into our propagation area, and we had to redo that. We were like, okay, we got to get a little smarter about this. So we kind of, we fenced it off. And then like in the trial plots, we also had these frameworks with this mesh wire. Like we were like, we got to barricade these seeds. And we actually were able to grow them in a couple different substrates to see what was best. The winner, of course, was biochar. And we still have them. I know. Isn't that interesting?
Biochar totally or biochar mixed in?
Biochar mixed in. Yep. And we were able to grow several hundred, and we've actually got them growing in a certain section on our property outside of the core park. And
oh, wow. Thriving. Cool. That's great.
Yeah. So a little assisted migration, seeing what will happen, but that's a fun project. And then without a doubt, the one we're best known for is our red spruce restoration work in the spruce fir forest. That's the one we've done the most work on. We are a part of SASRI, which is the Southern Appalachian Spruce Restoration Initiative. And that is a formally chartered organization that started out grassroots a decade ago. And it's got everybody in it. It's got U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Daughters of the American Revolution, Appalachian Trail Conservancy, Southern Highlands Reserve, National Forest Foundation, some state agencies, concerned citizens. And we work across state lines and try to emulate what these plant communities do to help each other. So Virginia, Tennessee, and North Carolina are what are focused together. Georgia fell off the radar with climate change. We're not doing any spruce fir restoration down in Georgia, and I don't think we'll be.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit more about the connection between the spruce and the flying squirrel? Because I don't think enough people understand how those two are connected there.
Yeah, the symbiotic relationship. It is pretty fascinating. These species pretty much got trapped down here in the high elevations of the Southern Alps with the last ice age, which is really hard to conceptualize. But thankfully, Pixar makes great movies and we can see squirrels chasing nuts and understand what's going on.
That's true, yeah.
They're caught down here in what we refer to as islands in the sky, which I love that term. It's very visual. And the symbiotic relationship between the Carolina northern flying squirrel and the red spruce tree is related to the survival. There is a southern flying squirrel that is more dominant than the northern flying squirrel, and so their habitat's being encroached on that way. But there's a nematode that occurs in their stomachs, and it weakens them. And so by getting nutrients from the red spruce trees, the conifer oils, and also there's truffles underground that they can dig up and eat those.
Huh. So,
I know. And that I've seen one.
Really?
Yeah. I've been out with a biologist and we were cruising around at the trunk of a red spruce and we dug one out. It was cool.
Wow.
And they eat all this stuff and it abates those nematodes. And so they're able to continue on and not fall out of and fall into extinction.
Yeah. Sure. No, I love the story of the squirrels. So that's so cool.
I got to go out one time pre-pandemic with the wildlife biologist to check the boxes.
Oh, cool.
And that was a really fun exercise to do. We go out in January, finding out where their habitat at. Habitat is critical for us to know where to restore according to our restoration criteria.
Yeah, sure. I want to go back for a second to the Toria, because the fact that biochar was your most successful germination. Was it germination or was it just overall growth? It's okay if you don't know.
No, I'm thinking back to the report right now. It was percentage of germination and height.
Yeah. So one of the things that I'd be curious of, and I'll probably end up cutting this out, but this is just a fun fact.
It's okay.
Because there's a hormone that's produced during the process of burning. It's called carotenes. And so what it does is it basically helps to kickstart one of those hormones pathways. And so I'm wondering if Toria could be a species that is dependent upon that.
Yeah, that's
because biochars burn stuff. So I'm also now curious if biochar could potentially help to be a germination aid for some things. So I'll look more into that. That's interesting.
Yeah. I see where you're going at with this, and I'm not as trained scientifically as you are. In my mind, I went down the same trail, and I think you're onto something.
Yeah, cool. I'll have to look more into that. Can you talk a little bit more about the garden itself? Because literally, for listeners out there, it's one of the most magical places that you'll ever visit in your entire life. I've been twice, and just every time that I can even get close, I'm consider myself thankful. But can you talk about some of the different areas of the garden?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for those kind words. I feel the same way about the gardens. I commute about 40 minutes every day to get up there from Brevard. And a lot of times visitors will say to me, you drive up here every day? And my response is, wouldn't you if you got the opportunity? Come on.
Yeah,
it's really magical. And thank you for allowing for some time to talk about this. I make it a point when I'm inviting someone up for the first time, I send them directions, like street by street directions. And one of the joys is looking at their faces when they come up from the parking area. And we haven't even gotten to the gardens yet, just the drive in. It is so magical. One of my good friends, I love this phrase. She says, we give good fern. And I think she's right. I think we do give good fern. When you come in our driveway, it's flanked by these very mature cinnamon ferns and then all the lichen on the trees. It just like sets this tone for what you're about to go into. And then, of course, you drive by one of our moss beds, which is huge, and just a sea of green and boulders. But if I could really had to pick, there are two garden rooms that are my favorite. And the first one is our wildflower labyrinth.
Yeah.
I like that room so much. And it's so architectural and so designed. But the story behind why it was designed like that is really cool, because that was going to be the drain field or the septic for those 22 homes that were
sited.
So way to make some lemonade out of lemons in that area. We were never clear cut in the middle of a woodland forest, but it was already there for us.
So yeah.
I just love it. There's definitely something spiritual going on up there. And to be able to see the difference in April to August in the plant growth of the perennials and the grasses is just stunning.
Yeah. Yes.
Then my other favorite room would be the pond. Oh, yeah. Area,
yeah,
with the view shed towards the Blue Ridge Mountains. That they, when they had this property and when they were developing the master plan, that was wooded and they didn't even know they had that view shed.
That's amazing.
And it adds so much layers of biodiversity for all the species, but also just having that water there. Humans are naturally drawn to go and explore. And I think they knocked it out of the park with that one.
Yeah, they did. W. Gary Smith, of course, was instrumental in designing and laying out a lot of the ways that Southern Highlands Reserve would look. What are some of the lessons that people can take away? Because we've got a lot of listeners out there that are really interested in ecological gardening and capturing the stories of their site and living that out in ecological native plant ways. So what are some of the lessons from the way Southern Highlands Reserve is designed can they take and implement in their own gardens?
I think some of the initial themes that drove them were don't mess it up.
Oh, yeah.
Don't mess up what's already here. And so that sort of evolved into a mentality of we're just polishing the stone. And how can we enhance it?
I love that.
And just make this better. And that was really the driving forces behind it. Gary is still very close with us at Southern Highlands Reserve, and he's such a kind, sweet man. He came to visit a couple different times and spoke at a symposium, and I was walking around with him, and I said, there are some things that we need to change in some of these garden rooms because of climate change. And designer to designer, I just want to have this like heart to heart with you. And he looked at me and he goes, Kelly, climate change wasn't really like a topic of how you designed in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And he said, you're going to have to make some tough decisions.
Yeah. So one of the questions I like to ask on the podcast is, let's say you were teaching a class or a semester-long class on conservation, but I want to take a slightly different slant on it. We're doing conservation from the perspective of landscapers, gardeners, professional horticulturists, people who are out there in the day-to-day life of taking care of these areas, et cetera. What are two or three core takeaways that you would want them to leave that class with so that they would be better prepared of enacting conservation and also being prepared for coming changes with climate, et cetera? What are some of those ideas you would really want them to take away from that class?
Sorry, my puppy just moved.
That's okay.
Trotted in. You're going to have to go chill out. You're not ready yet. Go lie down. I know you're bored. Go lie down. I love this question. I got to say, I really do love it. So what I would want students to take away from a semester-long conservation course with me would be to really start with being in the land, being in the landscape, being in the garden, logging time at different points of the day, during a rainstorm, during a drought, just really a huge observation phase. We're not going to play fetch right now. Literally brings me the toy. Ridiculous.
We've got some dog lovers on this podcast. I may just leave all this in.
Oh my gosh. So I really think that is a huge part of any type of gardening. And to me, conservation is gardening. And so be in the space, learn the space, take notes, pay attention to what is already happening in nature. And if there are things that we should mimic, or if there are things that we need to help with. So that would be like the foundation of the class. And then conservation work is a marathon. If you're looking for quick results, this is not your cup of tea. You got to be in it for the long game. And the other part I would really want to illuminate for them would be how critical partnerships are. And you do not have to do this alone. Many hands make light work. Find the other people in conservation that are as fired up about it as you are, and that's how you're going to get to your goal.
Yeah. What do you think about conservation in home gardens? Is that possible that people can assist with those efforts of planting things that may have once occurred there, don't anymore?
Absolutely. I can just look at my yard, and the case study of my little half acre is I inherited euonymus, butterfly bush, walnut trees, English ivy, red tip trees, all these mature species. And I was like, time for a big old edit. Let's get some ecosystem services in here.
Yeah.
Replacing, getting rid of all the exotic invasives. Also trying to get rid of anything that isn't high up on the ecosystem services it does for the food web and for overall biodiversity.
Yeah, because I know that there's a lot of people out there who are interested in not only doing it at home, but then also on even commercial projects where, they talk, instead of having turf grass here or instead of having invasive plants, let's plant natives that are to that site. Even green roofs have been pitched as these, again, islands in the sky, these areas up on the tops of buildings where you could potentially have conservation species.
100%. Habitat's habitat.
No, that's true.
And I really think I've been doing a personal experiment in my own yard. We've been chemical free for 8 years, and I have seen the biodiversity in my personal yard skyrocket.
Yeah.
It's been pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned assisted migration. What is that? And could you share your thoughts on that with listeners? Because I don't know if everybody's heard that term before.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best way to illustrate assisted migration is to go back to the Pixar movie, Ice Age, with the little squirrel and the nut, because that is assisted migration. That little guy just rolling that nut over glaciers. And fast forward to modern times. And so there are species that are locked in. They are only in this one location, even though their naturally occurring stand could have been the entire eastern seaboard, right? But now they're just this little tiny speck of a spot. And a lot of people in conservation are curious to see, especially with climate change and things shifting, if these species could rebound back where they once were. I know it's a kind of a hot topic and some people are really opinionated about it. I'm curious. I'm a very curious person. And so until something feels like this is really not good ecologically, I will follow my curiosity and see what's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's great. Whenever I visited last summer and we were being shown around, one of the things that was mentioned was that y'all did a biodiversity survey.
Yes.
And y'all assessed the biodiversity in the garden compared to out in the wild or the areas surrounding the garden. And the biodiversity was higher in the garden than it was in the surrounding areas.
That's true.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because, see, I find that fascinating.
Right.
Because people want us to become pure national park-like areas. But to me, that says that humans are part of these ecosystems and helping to encourage diversity. And maybe I've got a wrong hypothesis, but I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about the results of your survey.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was 2013, so it's been a minute. But it's okay. Myself and another staff wanted to present at EDRA, the Environmental Design Research Association. And so we submitted this research for the biodiversity project. And I thought it was my theory of, let's see what's going on. Is the core park more biodiverse than our natural woodlands? I'm curious. Mm. And we broke it down into seven layers. I can't remember all of them off the top of my head, but it was like water, insect, soil, just so we could have a baseline to compare. And I was a little shocked, too, to find out that the core park had more biodiversity. But this is how I was able to really understand it. One, we added the pond. Mm-hmm. And that's going to, you put water element into any landscape or any ecosystem, and that's going to increase your biodiversity. Tons of species related to that. And then the other part was the human aspect of us caring and tending for these garden rooms. And to your point, humans, we're not outside of these ecosystems. We're just one of the species in them. And we can have a detrimental effect or we can have a positive effect. And the work that we're doing at Southern Highlands Reserve is really just trying to make our garden rooms as biodiverse and as resilient as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any advice for people out there for the ways that they should plant? Of course, native, but are there other ways that y'all think about planting at Southern Highlands Reserve that help to reinforce those ideas about diversity, resiliency, et cetera?
Really looking at plant communities and how interconnected they are. Trees, mid-layer, ground layer, the weave of magic that's going on underground that we can only study a little bit. And I look in natural settings when I'm out hiking and out and about, and I'm like, oh, these are thriving together. This is interesting. And why are they thriving together? And so we try to take a nod from what's already being successful in nature. I love to go up to the Blue Ridge Parkway and look and see how things are going, because that's where the sauce is.
Yeah, it sure is. Most listeners don't know this, but you and I have been trying to record this podcast for a year.
And it's crazy.
I know, right? It's certainly a testament to our lives, but it's also a testament to the impact of climate change, because what really postponed it was Hurricane Helene. and the devastation that happened there. In fact, I think the week it hit, we were scheduled to record. I just messaged Holly and I was like, just don't worry about it. We'll pick this back up when we need to.
Yeah, thank you for that. We needed it for sure.
But the reason I wanted to bring up Hurricane Helene on here is because you were pretty much right there in ground zero and the surrounding areas of Western North Carolina. So it's been almost a year now. Ecologically, what are some of the responses that you've seen from that bad storm? And maybe take it from two perspectives. One, what really didn't get damaged? Or what was this idea of anti-fragile got hit, but is now better or stronger? But two, maybe also discuss, was there something that got hit and you're now starting to see rebound or change ecologically?
Yeah. That first one is really hard to answer, what didn't get hit. I think it is one of many wake-up calls that our species is getting about climate change, and they're becoming more and more frequent. And a lot of people said, Western North Carolina was supposed to be safe, according to climate modeling. And I like to, in a very kind way, remind people in the room that no one's safe when it comes to climate change.
Yeah.
But it's like playing Yahtzee on some level. But I will say this positive about it before I go into the species that need help. To see how humans banded together to help each other, that was amazing. In my town alone, cell service was down for days, and it could have been longer. I've put that chapter back on the shelf.
Yeah. Sorry for asking you to bring it up too.
No, it's good. I was at Cullowhee Native Plant Conference this weekend and I talked about
in
the presentation.
Yeah.
I think it's important to talk about it. I appreciate it. And we saw kids riding bikes, which we grew up doing that, but there weren't cell phones back then.
Yeah.
And as soon as the cell phones got turned back on, they were just back on them. So there were some, similar to the pandemic, these nods to, we need to slow down, we need to connect, we need to be a part of this instead of just disassociating with whatever we choose to disassociate with.
Yeah.
And then related to the species that need our help, it was a gut punch to everybody here in the region, seeing the devastation. And then for those of us in conservation work, it was tough. We were really just banding together and trying to support each other. And the U.S. Forest Service did a really good job of focusing on assessments. And then they held a meeting with all the partners in December and presented what they were able to assess from October until December. And then recently they held another meeting talking about their plan of action right now. And then, of course, mixed in there, there's an administration change, which always flips things on its head. And so we are focusing on anything related to Helene damaged areas and conservation work, because that's the marching orders for the federal government, is they can only work on restoration work from Helene damage. Unfortunately, Roan Mountain lost half of its, one side of it just got obliterated.
Wow.
And I know Roan Mountain is special to a lot of people, including me. I've hiked there so much. And so that's where we're going to focus some of our efforts. The big thing coming out was all the trees down. And so that's a fuel load.
Oh, and, yeah.
And everyone's terrified about that. And so the first thing out of the gate was, we need a fire ban, like immediately. And they were able to secure that. And now we're working through, how are we going to get the fuel load out so that we can go back and replant?
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of layers to it, but we are actively working on it. And then we've got other restoration projects that weren't necessarily damaged but got knocked off. Like, in addition to you and I not being able to do the podcast, that next week we're supposed to plant trees up at Graveyard Fields.
Oh, yeah. And that's another magical place. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But we got up there in December, and then we did it again in May. So we're back at it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. The reason I was asking about the resiliency, the anti-fragility aspect of it, is because in 2021, we had Snowmageddon in Texas. And granted, that wasn't a destructive, wiping the ground type storm like y'all experienced. But I was just curious if you had seen anything there that it was able to withstand it, because that's what a lot of gardeners and horticulturists are interested in right now, is we keep having these droughts or floods or fires or ice storms, whatever it may be. And it is devastating to watch whole plant communities getting wiped out. And I think that I'm still looking for the answers of how do we deal with that and how do we solve that. So thanks for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there is a magic bullet. I think that we're going to be learning and figuring it out together. And one of the things that's top of mind for me, in addition to just like resiliency, is when are we as a species going to really start talking about stormwater?
Yeah.
And I manage a non-urban environment, and it's top of mind for me. But in the urban environment, I think we got some work to do.
Yeah. And I've actually heard the argument that stormwater management is where horticulture needs to go. Like that, like it's always going to be a problem. And I was watching the news the other day, and it was just one of these TV stations was on in the restaurant. And it was like, why are flash floods increasing in frequency? And I'm just like, maybe warmer air holds more moisture. And
yeah. So, it's mind blowing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Stick your hand in a pot of boiling water. Why is my hand hurting?
Yeah. And I get it. To redo infrastructure is billions and trillions of dollars. But when you start to look at your return on investment from regions trying to rebound from situations like Snowmageddon or Helene, it makes a lot of sense to me to make the investment now.
Yeah, me too. Y'all also, one of the things too I want to highlight was Southern Highlands Reserve also recently built a brand new greenhouse. Yes. Yeah, so that's amazing. What was the thought process that went into deciding the schematics and layout and design that y'all have? Because I've seen photographs and it's gorgeous.
Thank you so much. You'll have to come back and visit.
I will.
So that was basically the presentation I gave at Colloe. We were a project of promise to close out the conference. So we grow the red spruce for Sazerie. I think there's one other, Kazri, which is the Central Apps Spruce Restoration Initiative. They're a little bit older than us, and they have a different restoration technique. They work with a gentleman that sends a seed out to Oregon, and they propagate the spruce there, and they freeze them, and they ship them back. In the Southern Apps, we have a different restoration style because we're underplanting in mixed deciduous forest. Mm. So the plugs, if we were to get plugs, have got to be pretty tall so that in the fall when the leaf drop lands, they don't just smother them and kill them.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So all this information will make sense in a second. So Southern Highlands Reserve had been growing spruce trees for the last 20 years. We're plant nerds. We go down in our nursery. We were like cold stratify six times, whatever the native seed. Nice. And we were doing this because 20 years ago, native plants really weren't in the industry like they are now, which I'm so grateful for. And we got really good at growing red spruce trees. And then when we got involved with Sazerie, we started producing them for them, and we do 1 gallon size, which, so it's a mature tree. It's not really even a plug, but we need that for the survival in the mixed deciduous forest.
Right. They're like, what, 2-3 feet tall or so?
Yeah, 18 to 24 inches for sure. And so here we are, this small nonprofit growing all the trees for the Southern Blue Ridge Mountains. And we're like, they're like, we need hundreds of thousands of trees. And I said, you're not going to, what did my mom say? You can't get blood out of a turnip. I still don't really understand that, but I think it's applicable here. And so we started having conversations about how we can increase our capacity. And then I also wanted to enhance the visitor experience. And so it's a forward-facing propagation center instead of a back of the house. And so tourists get to come and see what we do. And then all roads lead back to stormwater management in this conversation, Jared. But we had a great opportunity to address it because we're on a mountain. And so we put in probably $500,000 worth of green infrastructure in this project to address the stormwater, cisterns to French drains to a rain garden to a mountain bog. And we got tested by Helene.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did those things fare?
It was like, let's hope the engineering works out. Fingers crossed. But it did.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, our rain garden held and there was no destruction to the creek behind us. And we got just shy of 41 inches in 5 days.
My goodness.
It was nuts.
That's insane.
Yeah, I'm really proud of that work. And I think it's an opportunity for other people that live in mountain communities that have similar roads that we have to think about how they could address their stormwater. Because before we got involved, we're right next to the Nantahala Forest. And so all of that rainwater and debris was just going straight into the forest. And what an opportunity to do the right thing.
Yeah, sure. Is there anything else that you want to talk about Southern Highlands Reserve or anything before I ask some wrapping up questions?
I really just want to express gratitude to everyone that has been a part of Southern Highlands Reserve and helping us get to where we are. Our volunteers, our partners, our donors. We would not have been able to build that greenhouse without the help of many hands. It was named after the late, great Bunny Mellon. The Gerard B. Lambert Foundation was a lead donor in that project. The Band Foundation, National Forest Foundation, just to name a couple. So yeah. Just want to highlight how important it is to work together.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing. Are there any practices that you do on a regular basis that help center you as a horticulturist or help refuel your creativity?
I was just talking about this with an intern yesterday. I refer to it as flow, like getting into the flow.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And I get into the flow by being able to garden, to physically connect with the land, whether that's weeding, pruning, walking through deadheading, just immersing myself in the garden room.
Yeah, beautiful. Do you have a favorite garden, nature, plant book that you love to return to time and time again?
Yes. I don't have a copy of it here with me, but Wildflowers of Tennessee, the Ohio Valley, and the Southern Appalachians.
Nice. Who's the author?
By Dennis Horn and Tavia Cathcart.
Nice. Cool.
It is awesome. It's the book I go to. I don't have any apps on my phone where I can identify. I am old school. I will take a picture of it on my phone. And then when I get back to my office, I pull that book out and I just want to like thumb through it. I love that book. I just got a copy of Thomas Waltz's book. I haven't cracked it open yet, but it looks beautiful and it's called Listen to the Land. I love that.
Nice. Yeah.
I also really Thomas Rainier and
Claudia.
Yeah, because she's so sweet. I love Claudia. And yeah. Claudia West's book, Planting in a Post-Wild World. I try to bring that to people's attention. Those are some of my go-tos.
Yeah, that's great. Is there a garden myth that a lot of gardeners and horticulturists believe, but your research or experience has shown otherwise?
I think I'm going to go big on this one. I am going to throw out to the world on a podcast that I believe that every single person has the ability and the capacity to have a green thumb.
I love that. Yeah, I love that. It's what is it in the movie Ratatouille? Everybody can cook.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think too many people have gotten caught in the doom loops. They try it, they don't know, they think they're a failure. And it's the same thing with kids and math. I'm not good at math or whatever. And
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm still li 16 years later, I'm still living through that myth with our son in math.
yeah. What's got you excited right now, either in your garden or at Southern Highlands Reserve, something you've seen in the garden there?
In my garden, I am really excited. We redid our front bed with all natives. We had all these Chinese azaleas, and it was just like, ugh. So we remodeled our house, and I was like, this is the perfect time to rip things out. And so we ripped it out. And so it's 2 years in, and it's just this, I love it. I've got Kalmia latifolia minuet. That's one of my ones. I love that cultivar. And then I've just got it like bursting with all kinds of different perennials,
Nice.
native perennials, so we can have a little bit of a flower arrangement to go with dinner.
Yeah, nice. So, Kalmia latifolia is native all the way down into Louisiana, which is,
Really?
yeah, I know. It's like right there on that eastern tip. But I'd love to get some germplasm at some point in time because that's got to be heat tolerant. It's just got to be.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I did not know that. The garden room I'm really excited about right now
Yeah.
at Southern Highlands Reserve is our mountain bog.
Oh, yeah. With the carnivorous plants. Yeah. Is
We
this
are.
the new one or is this the one down by the pond?
This is a brand new one we constructed,
Oh, nice.
and we are working with partners to try to find rare and endangered species so that it can be really a showcase of
That's
education.
awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah, some Sarracenia jonesii. Man, I'm
Yeah.
excited about bogs.
Yeah, me too. I have carnivorous plants at my house and I've tried the bog approach. I think our water supply is not that good, so I've just gone to growing them in kiddie pools and
Yeah.
then just that way, even if you have to water them some to this during the summer, it usually ends up leaching it out. I also wanted to ask, what's up with the picture behind you? Because
Yeah.
I've been enjoying looking at this the whole time we've been talking. It looks
Oh,
like it's a moth.
yeah, it is. I think plants people are artists. I think you've heard this before, but gardening is the slowest art form.
Yeah.
And we had a friend that was finishing up her art degree at Brevard College. And in addition to showcasing some of her pieces, they were for sale. And we fell in love with this one. I really can't remember what moth it is off the top of my head, but I just think it's so pretty.
It's got, just for listeners out there, it's got a white wing pattern, black spots, and then highlights of blue and orange on the body. So, yeah, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then, in a nod to the Native Plant podcast, I'll probably get eviscerated if I don't ask this. What's your dog's names?
Yes, for sure. So we have two doodles. We have an older doodle that's nine. The one barking right now is the younger one.
Oh, see, I can't even hear it.
Okay,
Yeah,
good.
I can't even hear it. Yeah.
So our older doodle's name is Bizzy with a B, Bizzie. And our younger doodle's name, Roo, Roo.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cute. Second to last question on the podcast. What can we do to share the love of plants and help to inspire conservation in more people out there?
I think we need to connect more. I think we need to take a step away from the divisive nature that has gained some momentum and to really remember that we're on this planet together and show compassion and kindness and teach each other and learn from each other. There's no way I'll ever know it all. And there's beauty in that.
Yeah.
There's beauty in that curiosity, and I think that we can achieve anything if we work together.
No, be curious, not judgmental.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Last question, where can people learn more about you and Southern Highlands Reserve? And I'm even going to put this plug in too, because y'all are so focused on conservation. Are there ways that people can help to support y'all as well too?
Yes, thank you for that. Our website would be the first place I would send people to. They can learn about Southern Highlands Reserve, how to visit, and also there's the And also, you can donate on our website. The other opportunity would probably be through social media. We have a growing social media catalog. The interns this summer have really taken it and ran with it, and I'm excited about what they've been doing. And also, come to conferences. I've been doing a lot of public speaking this year and trying to get the word out, to kind of circle back to how we started with not a lot of people know about Southern Highlands Reserve. I get it. And we, for the last decade, have been trying to get the word out, and we want more people to know about what we're doing and the important work of conservation of the Southern Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah. And for people who want to come visit, y'all usually have tickets for sale in advance.
We do. And right now, we've got a waiting list going, and we just, the waiting list open to see, we're over 500, and we're gosh, what are we going to do? And we've increased tours.
So
I think there were like 7 to 10 tours when I started, and now we're closer to 40 to 50 tours a year.
Wow.
So we're trying so hard to increase our capacity in a sustainable way for our staff model.
Yeah.
And thank goodness for volunteers, because we have these docents now that will increase our visibility by giving tours. And back in the day, it just used to be me.
Yeah. How many volunteers do y'all have?
Over 30.
Oh, wow. That's great. Awesome. Cool. Yeah. All right. Thank you for your time today, Kelly. I really appreciate it. And again, I always love to talk to somebody from the mountains. So thanks again for everything you shared, from thoughts about conservation and how we can each take our own steps in our own home gardens, trying to make the world a better place.
It's been my pleasure. Really enjoyed taking time to chat with you. We really don't do it enough in our profession. So thank you for the opportunity with the podcast.
My pleasure. Yeah. Till next time. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. Do you have questions or comments? You can visit theplantasticpodcast.com for show notes and to reach out and say hi. Remember, plants can't talk, but we can. The plant world needs people to share how wonderful these green organisms are. So tell someone a fun fact about plants. Make it simple, make it remarkable, and most of all, make it plantastic. Until next time, keep growing.